You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 48 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Remember, you can connect with us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or visit us on the web, socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all. Today is the day we finally talk about social media and spear phishing attacks, which is something that I've been wanting to do for a while now. If you remember, in our 2017 Year in Review episode, we talked a bit about spear phishing and social media and what it means for cyber attacks on the Pentagon and the Department of Defense. And in doing some research for that episode, it kind of sparked one of my interests. And since then, I've been digging around and seeing what's out there in terms of media coverage about this. And I kind of put all of that media coverage together and developed a theoretical model of spear phishing on social media that'll be coming out in the Columbia Journal of International Affairs. And as I was digging into the academic literature on the topic, of which there isn't too much, I came across the work of Dr. Arun Viswanath, who is an associate professor of communication at the University of Buffalo. And Dr. Viswanath has done some really interesting work running experiments and trying to figure out what predicts people's likelihood to open up malicious links through social media. And I think this research is really important because there's a lot of, you know, coverage around spear phishing attacks on politicians, generally in terms of email. So that's the kind of stuff like the DNC hacking that happened in the last U.S. election cycle. But the idea of social media as an attack vector is not so reported about, yet we know it's happening. There was a case last year where over 10,000 Pentagon employees were attacked on Twitter with messages that hide malicious links that once they're clicked on can allow a hacker to go into a government network. And we know that in at least one case, it wasn't the Pentagon employee who was targeted, but his wife. And once the wife's device was infected, then that hacker was able to move into the Pentagon systems through a shared Wi-Fi network, which brings into question this whole Internet of Things, which we also discuss in this episode. But just to outline a bit why looking at social media is important for cyber attacks, first of all, there's a massive amount of information that could be collected on government employees through social media. Number two, social media are typically high-trust environments where people are more likely to open links than they would be via email. Number three, there's more sophisticated tools now than there were before to automatically generate messages that can be tailored to certain individuals with just a little bit of computer code. And I think this is precisely what happened in the case of the Pentagon employees, which was basically their usernames were fed into a program that goes onto Twitter, pulls their most recent messages, develops a machine learning algorithm to generate a predicted message to them based on their interest with a malicious link inside of the tweet. So again, high trust environment, message tailored to you, you might click it, then your network gets infected. And this is a problem. But it's important to note, and something that me and Dr. Viswanath discuss in this episode, that spear phishing attacks are only one element of what Dr. Viswanath calls the dark triad. So on the one hand, you have spear phishing. The second part of the triad is trolling. And the third is disinformation. And these things together are what the Russians are using to try to undermine trust in American democracy. And in this interview, we're going to talk about those three different facets, how they relate to one another, and what governments are trying to do to stop it. So without further ado, let me bring on Dr. Arun Viswanath. He is Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Buffalo. He is also a faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center at Harvard University and president of Avant Research Group, a strategic market research consulting firm. Dr. Viswanath, thanks so much for taking the time out and welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Mike, it's very good to be here.
So most of our listeners are probably familiar with the concept of phishing, but can you break down for us the difference between a phishing attack and a spear phishing attack?
So, you know, generally when people talk about phishing, they're talking about something that's what we now call pretexting, which is what the Nigerian scam used to be. Remember these emails that people used to get, I hope that people still get, which is an email from a quote-unquote Nigerian prince, you know, with tons of money lying around requiring, let's say, your bank account in order to clear it. Those are the kind of attacks that we used to call phishing attacks, or at least most people think of as phishing attacks. The difference between that and spear phishing is, number one, it's much more targeted, it's much more personalized, but more importantly, The object of that is not to have you respond with some information, but to have you do something, and doing something very, very, very small, very minor, at least for the end user, clicking on a hyperlink, for instance, opening an attachment, for instance. And these actions that you do can happen, you know, in split seconds, unlike pretexting and, you know, the old school phishing attacks where you're actually responding and then they're responding back, and those things happen iteratively over time. So this is the difference between the two. And, you know, the differences appear to be minor, but the consequences are just phenomenally different and phenomenally more catastrophic. Spear phishing, you know, leading to breaches, leading to compromises, leading to ransomware. Mm-hmm. Pretexting, you know, has a very low hit rate and success rate in general.
Yeah. And I want to get into more like those different types that you're mentioning, but I want to hone in first on phishing attacks on social media specifically. What makes social media suited for spear phishing attacks?
You know, social media is different from email in the sense it's not anonymous, right? So for the most part, when people receive, let's say, a phishing attack on social media, it comes very differently first, right? So unlike email-based phishing, which comes from, let's say, a stranger or a person appearing to be someone you know, mm-hmm. a social media phishing campaign could be in many different ways, right? It could be a fake friend request from someone who appears to be someone you know or from a total stranger. And it can also be a message that comes within social media, let's say via WhatsApp, which is one form of it, or through, let's say, you know, Facebook Messenger. So this could be from somebody who is your friend or who appears to be your friend or come from a total stranger. So now what you're having is these multiple different gateways through which these attacks can come, but they all appear to come from a person or someone who you may or may not know. So there's already this higher trust that people have on social media, and add to that maliciousness, and you have a recipe for something that's going to be a lot more successful than, let's say, email, where we're used to junk mail and bulk mail and stuff that we ignore routinely. Mm-hmm. So what we find is, you know, social media attacks are a lot more successful because people trust a lot more.
Right. And so what's kind of the end goal of these attacks?
You know, these attacks, and if you're talking about social media, I mean, these attacks are, again, you know, they run the whole gamut. It could be something as simple as, you know, trying to get information about the individual, right? A couple of years ago, I think we had this group of young people in Hollywood. It was called the Hollywood Bling Ring. And what they would do is they would track people's social media actions, especially Hollywood actors and celebrities. And then they would break into their houses based on what they would see them posting. So if you knew where the person was, you know they're not at home. Or if you know what they've bought, you know what you can break in and steal. So that's one end, right? So that's robbery at one end. Home invasion. There's also attacks that try to do, you know, these romantic attacks, right? Where you claim to be, these hackers would claim to be, you know, a common thing that people claim to be are veterans. Or they say they're deployed somewhere. And then they would ask for money. You know, these are like romantic scams. You know, they try to hook in people, women, you know, with, and try to get anything from, you know, MoneyGrams to tickets to come back home. But these are all like, you know, the low-end scams that are trying to steal information, steal data, steal money. But then you have the other end of it. The other end of it is espionage, right? These are state attacks that are trying to create fake profiles. A couple of years ago, we had a naval admiral whose profile was pretty popular. There were lots of people who had connected to him. He was a NATO admiral. And what they found out, you know, I think about a year later, that was not his profile at all. And a lot of the people who had connected to him thinking he was legitimate. And these people who connected to him were basically giving away information about their location, about where they were, and about where the troops were, for instance, where the naval movements were. Much of this information is not supposed to be out there, but these are very simple ways in which these attacks are done.
Yeah, and apart from that, I've been reading a bit into this, and once, you know, let's say someone clicks on a link that's been put through a spear phishing attack, a malicious actor can go inside of a government network or an infrastructure and, you know, collect information, but also in the case of infrastructure, shut it down, right? And there's kind of a concern as to that there are state-sponsored actors within a variety of networks across the globe that are just waiting to push the button.
That's right. That's right. And there's this has been happening quite a bit, right? And back in 2015, in downstate New York, we had a dam. The sluice gates of the dam was being moved. It was Bowman Area Dam. I think it's in Westchester County. And there was the sluice gates had been infiltrated by Iranian hacker group, and they were moving it. And that tells you what's possible. A lot of these infrastructure facilities, and they're all of them, right? It could be the electric grid. It could be, you know, nuclear facilities. It could be the telephone system. All of these have been hacked, can be hacked, and they, you know, for the most part, many of them remain vulnerable in many parts of the world. Ukraine had a major shutdown of the electric grid. Even their telephone system shut down on that same day, one of the coldest days of the year 2 years ago. Israel has been attacked likewise, you know, where the electric grid had to be rebooted because they were suffering a ransomware attack. Mm. So these are not just possibilities. These are actually happening or have happened. And so, you know, these are real concerns, and they all come in through spear phishing, where the bad guys get access, they get a foothold into the network, and then they either lurk in the system or they move through the system looking for vulnerabilities. And then eventually on one day when they're ready for it, they exploit it.
And so how are these types of attacks detected by governments or platforms? What kind of measures are in place right now to kind of counter these attacks?
Right. So there's a lot of things that we are doing, right? But let's understand, like, at the core of these attacks, these are social engineering attacks. So these are attacks that are compromising users, right? And users are very hard to protect because there's one, there's many of them. Two, they're very heterogeneous. And three, the number of actions that they take are not limited to just, let's say, a desktop environment. You're going across devices, you're going across platforms, you're going home and working on computers. Some of them are bringing it into work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, protecting everything is hard because in the one end, the internet makes us much more open, right? There's more devices, there are more technologies, there are more gateways in. On the other hand, we're expecting everybody to be much more constrained like we used to be in the mainframe environment base. So there's this constant tension between these two things. So protecting everything is becoming very hard. We have a lot of things in place. Some of them are technical safeguards, right? So we have net capture. We have different ways in which we're trying to segment networks. We're trying to create air gaps. So in other words, you know, if I could get into your computer, you're not connected, let's say, to the company server so that I can't make my way through to it. So only the people who have access or need access or who are deemed necessary are given that kind of access. So there's various ways in which we're doing this. However, you know, on the other end, the bad guys are also getting better, more sophisticated, more stronger, more smarter. Their attacks are getting more virulent, and they're trying to find newer and newer gateways to come in. This is, you're in a match where, you know, the adversary is constantly trying to get better, and you're trying to play catch up. So it's not completely sealed yet.
Yeah, and there's an interesting example I was reading about where a Pentagon government official was hacked, but it was actually his wife who was spearfished, and the attacker basically moved through the shared home Wi-Fi network, which brings me to this idea of infrastructure and the Internet of Things, which I think creates a huge potential for these attacks to scale.
That's right. And last year, you know, late last year, we saw, you know, the Internet of Things and distributed denial of service attacks being perpetrated using like home DVRs and, you know, Wi-Fi devices at home. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to see the potential of an interconnected world, you know, being attacked by devices that you thought were not necessary or not to be protected or would not have an impact on an organizational network, right? So today what we're starting to see is, you know, this portability of attacks. And it's not just coming from home, right? It could be you're on a public Wi-Fi network at a coffee shop and you have an infected device there, or, you know, the Wi-Fi network itself is infected. And what it's doing is it's putting malware into your laptop and you don't realize it and you bring it to work. These are real fears that we have right now.
Yeah. And I was speaking with an official, I forget the agency, somewhere in the Secret Service, and was saying that they're concerned about this in the upcoming congressional elections because malicious actors can set up Wi-Fi networks when campaign officials are on the run and on their phones and they're just connecting.
Right.
And not necessarily high level. The target can be a lower level staffer who, once inside the network, the actor can move through the campaign.
Right. And these are, you know, typical man-in-the-middle attacks, and they're very easy to do. And part of the problem is that, you know, today, given how ubiquitous email is, you can compromise one person's email, even a staffer's email, and get enough information about the individual they're working with because they're sharing emails back and forth. People send each other emails. And you know, you don't need the head of the government's emails in order to effect a major compromise or disrupt an election. What the DNC hack taught us, you did not need Hillary Clinton's personal email responses. You could do it with John Podesta's, or you could do it with somebody even below him. Mm-hmm. Because the object of many of these attacks, again, you know, they range, right? Everything from, you know, stealing data to compromising to embarrassing. But the object of many of these political campaigns is to disrupt, not necessarily to, you know, get one candidate one over the other. But if you want to disrupt, any data, any information, anything scandalous can be problematic.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to keep in, you know, to contextualize that these spear phishing attacks are kind of one element of an overall disinformation strategy or an overall cyber operation, influence operations. Can you go in? I know you've talked about this dark triad. Do you want to go ahead and kind of unpack that for us?
Right. You know, unfortunately, what happens is most people in government, as well as policymakers, even the media, you know, everybody tends to focus on the event of the day, right? So for a while, we were talking about breaches when the DNC hack was going on in 2016. Last year, we were talking about social media and fake news. And then this year, we're now talking about social media and, let's say, you know, the targeting of advertisements. But really, these all are concerted campaigns that act together. They act in concert. These are not, you know, three separate events, but they're actually one coordinated campaign. And they were, in the case of the last presidential elections, they were conducted by, you know, the Russian intelligence. And what was this? So the three things that I call the dark triad of the internet are three sets of things. It's hacking campaigns, it's disinformation campaigns, and it's organized trolling campaigns. Right. So if you put the three things together, what do they mean? First, you know, you use actions like spear phishing to breach data, to hack into networks, and to get that data out. So that was the first thing that the Russians did. In this case, they compromised the DNC servers. They got a lot of the data, and then they released it in WikiLeaks. The second thing that they did is they engaged in a massive disinformation campaign. And for that, they used a lot of fake news networks, and they created fake websites. They created all these fake news articles. And what they did is they populated the internet full of that using organized trolling campaigns, something that we talked about, the Internet Research Agency, a group out of the Kremlin, sponsored by the Kremlin, out of Moscow, that basically has, you know, 30 to 50 operatives who create fake, you know, live journal pages, create fake blog pages, create fake social media accounts, Twitter handles, and YouTube accounts. And what they're doing is they're using all the data that they've stolen, all the fake news links that they have, and they're feeding that into newer and newer news cycles by commenting on news boards, by commenting on Reddit, by commenting on, let's say, you know, Fox News or MSNBC's comment sections. And so what you're doing is you're giving air to these events, and you're kind of seeding doubt, right? Ominously, the remember this old game of telephone, you know, the children used to play, you know, where you have this the piece of news that you spread from one person to the other, and you see how that news kind of disperses and becomes completely surreal by the end of it. And incidentally, that game, you know, has its roots in a Russian, old Russian game. So I'm not surprised that, you know, these guys were doing this. But the dark triad is basically what this is all about. Dark triad is this idea of using these three kind of internet 2.0 ideas to compromise, you know, nations for this matter.
Yeah, and those three aspects of it, hacking, disinformation, and trolling, can all be done through social media. And I want to kind of focus on social media as an attack vector for a second and ask you, what are the most popular platforms for social network-based phishing? And are there differences across platforms as to how these attacks might be conducted?
So right now, I mean, the most popular is, of course, Facebook, right? I mean, again, we're talking about phishing campaigns, in this case, creating fake profiles and seeding fake news. Some of that is going to start changing as Facebook changes its internal policies. But I can tell you one thing, they're not doing much to change the whole idea of how people create fake profiles. It's still very easy to do it. In fact, I know of somebody who had a fake profile created of them after somebody hacked their account yesterday. And this is news that I just heard about, where what happened was this individual's Facebook login and password was compromised. And what the bad guys did, which is pretty smart, is they downloaded, once they got into, let's say, your Facebook profile, they downloaded your friend list. And then they just recreated a new Facebook account. They opened a new profile with your name and refriended all of these individuals. And in the meantime, the victim, this person I know, she changed her password and log in. So the bad guys couldn't enter her network anymore, but they didn't need to.
Right. And I think that would be what Facebook would consider a duplicate account.
That's right. But it's a duplicate. It's a hacked duplication.
Yeah. And I think I was reading one of their quarterly reports, and roughly, I think 12% of their platform is duplicate accounts, right?
But just think about 12% of how many? A billion users? Yeah. And that's a phenomenally large number. right? About 2 years ago, we got some of the data that about 15 to 18% were duplicates or fake accounts or not, you know, existent, non-existent accounts. And it is a hard nut to crack. But so Facebook remains the most popular when it comes to phishing because there are a lot more users there. And it's a lot more, you know, there's a lot more data on it that can be used. So it's not just how many users do you have, but also how many users can I find out about by getting into your network? That's why Cambridge Analytica, you know, was focused on Facebook legitimately as against, let's say, using Twitter, right? Because the purpose of the network is different. One is a dissemination tool. The other is a communication tool. Facebook builds itself as that communication tool, which is kind of like communicating back and forth, whereas Twitter is more of a dissemination tool where you communicate to people indirectly, one to many. The other account that we're starting to see some activity on is LinkedIn, because a lot of people are moving to LinkedIn, although the data that they have on LinkedIn is much more cleaner. It's professional network data. But that data is still important. Remember that. If I can find out where you work, the phishing emails I can send you on your email change. So what we're now seeing in the last year or two, which I think what makes these phishing campaigns a little bit more dangerous now, is that we're seeing content aggregation happening at the phisher level. So what the phishers are doing is they're taking content from, let's say, LinkedIn about a person and using that to build spear phishing emails that are much more targeted. Likewise, they're going to Facebook, finding out likes, interests, data, and coming up with attacks that are much more targeted. This way, the attacks have a higher success rate. They already are pretty successful, but they have a higher success rate.
Right. I think it's interesting that the profile of the network kind of influences the type of attack. So on Facebook, you know, it's about friend connections, so you can download someone's friend list. On LinkedIn, you might go and, you know, find a low-level employee and find out their connections to get the data from the organization. But what about platforms like WhatsApp that are encrypted and are really for close communication between friends? Are we seeing phishing attacks in those platforms as well?
We are seeing a few, but remember, a lot of the data never comes out. We never find out because it's a one-to-one, right? I mean, just like we don't really have a grip on how many text-based attacks are happening, how many messaging-based attacks are happening, but they still happen, right? So one of the things that we start seeing is, you know, we're seeing these attacks emerging on different platforms. We see a lot of attacks happening via just plain old telephone systems. Right? Like the IRS scam is something that people do via telephone systems. You know, the one advantage with things like WhatsApp, even iMessaging, is you can block users.
Right.
As long as you know that there's a problem. Right? But the data on it is harder to get. Because remember, once you compromise a person's WhatsApp account, there really isn't much more that you can get except the list of people who are in their contact list. And that data is actually much more easier to get once you compromise their email address. Because remember, a lot of people, you know, they combine their contact lists. So you got to understand what the hackers are after. So if I want to get someone's contact list, it's much more easier, much more effective, and much more valuable for me if I could do this via their email account than, let's say, via WhatsApp, right? The encryption doesn't matter at this case because, you know, I'm not trying to understand the content that they're sharing because the content is irrelevant for the most part. Although, let's not forget, with Android devices, there are malware strains that are out there. And there is a demonstration that I've seen somewhere where, you know, using a messaging tool, you can infiltrate a person's device to such an extent that anything that they type, anything that they send, anything that they have on it, you can start logging in much the same way Facebook was logging people's phone records, for instance.
Right. Or a marketing company doing social media listening. You can just collect so much data.
That's right.
Can be used to inform these targeted attacks.
That's right. And so that's the danger there, right? I mean, with WhatsApp, you know, iMessaging, you know, whatever is out there, it's not necessarily the content alone. It's the connections. Remember, it's the same thing with Facebook. It's who are you connected to and what can I get from those connections?
Right. And building on this idea of connections, and I know this is something you've written about in your research, is this idea of the contagion effect, that once you successfully breach, you know, someone's profile because of their connections, you can scale that up. And that has some pretty interesting implications. Can you go into what that contagion effect is?
Right. And so the contagion effect here, the one that you're referring to, is, you know, how successful can a bad guy, a hacker, be once he or she infiltrates, let's say, the first network or the first victim, once you get the first victim, right? So let's look at something like social media. So we've done these experimental pieces where actually we friend people, we create a fake profile, a normal-looking fake profile, average-looking fake profile, rather, And then we, you know, send these connections out, these friend requests out. Once we have people connecting to us, how easy is it for that bad guy to now start spreading through the network of that person's friends? That's something that we have actually looked at. And what we have found is once you get a few strong connections, and what I mean by strong connections, what I mean is once you can get the first few victims who are relatively popular, right, in quotes, then the success of your attack is actually magnified. What do I mean by relatively popular? So you have some people on social media who collect friends, literally collect friends. And these tend to be younger people, but there are also some people out there in the media who want to see this as a badge of honor, right? They see, you know, you'll have these people with 3,000-4,000 network friends. These individuals are what I consider to be particularly good targets for the bad guys. Because one, they don't know who their friends are. Two, they'll friend anybody. They're not very careful about who they friend. But the problem is that the people they're connected to may not be similar to them to that extent. But then once they see this guy or this person, this hacker in that network, they may start connecting with them.
Right. They're sort of like a beachhead for the larger network.
That's right. So if you can collect enough, like, you know, people out there who are relatively popular on a particular network and start friending them, what we start seeing is that that contagion effect is much stronger. Those attacks diffuse very fast and they look like regular friend request campaigns. In other words, you know, it looks like a new person who came on social media and it's just, you know, they're almost analogous to a very legitimate request process.
Yeah. And it makes me think about this, something I was reading in one of your papers that has to do with the quantitative social media metrics, or what you call friend cues. So actually, I thought this was quite interesting that in your experiment, you had users sending friend requests, one set without pictures and others with, you know, the number of friends that were attached. And it turns out that users were more likely to accept friend requests from profiles that had no picture, but the higher friends. So the it's actually the friend cues that override the visual content. I think that's super interesting.
That's right. And this is a critical understanding of how people are, right? So what are people using social media for? People are using social media to connect to other people. That's the primary driver. So the cues that matter, right, are the cues that tell us who is this person, but more importantly, who are they connected to? And so what we did in our experiment is we looked to see, you know, what facets of that profile that you get. So remember, with Facebook, the profile request is relatively standard. And they did that on purpose. They did it such that it's easy for people to connect to other people. The whole idea of Facebook is to get a lot of people to connect. And so we manipulated some of this, right? So we had one profile without a picture, without any friends. And we also created one with a picture and with no friends. Then we created one with a picture and, let's say, 10 fake friends, five men, five women, and one without a picture and just 10 fake friends. And what we found is people, even if there wasn't a picture, as long as you saw this person having some connections, in this case, 10, which is hardly any number, people thought that that person was legitimate. In fact, I think not having a picture helps because it adds a layer of ambiguity just enough to say, maybe I know this person. And don't forget that what happens with social media is that person with 10, once he gets that 11th and the 12th and the 13th, that number count starts building up. So the count, when you begin, if it's about 10, starts getting bigger and bigger as more and more people come in. You know, it is analogous to another operation, another phenomenon that we see. If you ever go to, you know, a restaurant and or a coffee shop, they have a tip jar. A tip jar that has absolutely no money in it generally gets no more tips. But a tip jar, which is populated with a bunch of dollar bills that it looks like it's overflowing, gets actually a lot more. Because people think, well, seems to be that everybody's tipping this person. So it becomes the social norm. So this is kind of like the underlying phenomenon where that the number, the friend count, serves as a cue. It triggers a reactive behavior on the part of victims.
Yeah, I thought that was super interesting. And also, What was fascinating was the difference between a desktop and a mobile device in terms of the graphic cues.
Right.
So people who are on a mobile device are much more likely to accept a friend request, you know, presumably if it a spear phishing actor, because the visual cues that you can actually interpret are minimized on the device.
Right.
Could you talk about that?
Yeah, and remember, see, a lot of the devices are, you know, today we have apps, right? So we have a Facebook app. The same goes for email. You know, you have different email clients that have different apps. So what we're seeing is we have apps today when it comes to email, when it comes to social media, for Facebook, for instance. These apps on mobile devices are made to render on a much smaller screen. So what the developers do is they strip away a lot of content so that the mobile experience is analogous to the desktop environment or the desktop experience, but it's really not the same. There are fewer cues in it. There's fewer navigation options in it because you can't do the same things, right? You can't just hover over, for instance, with a mouse on a particular email address or a URL, which you could do on a desktop screen. You can't do that on a phone. So number one, there's less data on it. There's less information on it. Mm-hmm. Number two, the information that is there has been stripped down. So the things that you could have done on a desktop, you can do. And number three, and this is the most important part, this is where the user comes in. How we use these devices is different. You know, we're generally walking, we're talking, we're doing other things, we're multitasking. So we are not only compromised cognitively, but the environment also constrains what we can do. So, you know, in order to check a person's profile on, you know, a Facebook app on mobile device, you got to go through multiple screens, multiple clicks, you got to go back and forth. It's a lot easier to just hit accept.
Yeah, and that's especially worrying when you think about, you know, something like 90% of Facebook users are accessing the device from their mobile.
And it's not just Facebook anymore, right? A lot of people are using the internet primarily through their device. They're using it, you know, for a lot of things, from shopping to talking to communicating to email, you know, to a lot of the things that, you know, traditionally, well, 5 years ago, which is traditionally, or 10 years ago, before, you know, the explosion of smartphones, we were doing a lot of these operations on desktop environments where we had a lot more information. And even then we were making mistakes. Mm.
I think by now, the listeners are probably starting to get a bit anxious or a bit worried as to the prevalence of these attacks on social media. What advice would you give to someone in order to be kind of cognizant or aware of increasing their security from these attacks?
Well, you know, if you're talking about social media, right, if you're talking about Facebook, I think one of the most important things people need to do is we can't be, you know, we have to look to who we have as our friends. And it makes sense to quite regularly go through the network and see how many of these people are actually still active? How many of these people do I still know? Mm-hmm. So very often we just friend people and forget about it. Years later, we get some requests from them and we comply. That's the most dangerous place to be in right now. So that's one thing, right? Look through your networks. Look and see how many of these people are really people out there that you know or that you still want to know. And I do this quite often, and I think everybody should do it. The second thing is, you know, Facebook itself is providing more options now. It's allowing you, for instance, to download your entire history. And this is a very important thing. I think everybody should do that. Find out who's tracking you, what has been tracked off you, who your data has been sold to, for instance. And how many advertisements, you know, have you gotten, or how many advertisers out there know about you? Important pieces of data, right? That helps you get more informed about your social media presence. And the third thing is, don't fall, you know, get educated about these. So for instance, if you see a request from somebody who is a friend of yours on social media, question the request, even if it appears legitimate. You know, one of the things that we found is in all the attacks that I've done on social media, not one person, victim or non-victim, ever asked one important question. Was that person for real? They always assumed that it was a real person, but just not somebody they knew, or a sloppy person because they didn't put their photograph on their profile, but just not somebody they knew. They never asked the critical question, could this entire thing be fake? Could there just be a bot behind the whole thing? And we're seeing that as well.
Yeah, and hopefully, I think, you know, as the prevalence of bots and fake accounts starts to become more into the public sphere, that people will be a little more... I think there's just so much trust in these platforms, and I think that's kind of been undermined a bit, and I think that it might actually be a healthy thing to bring in some skepticism.
I believe so. I believe having that skepticism, you know, is critical. And I think the fourth thing that I think all your listeners must get, and you know, is, you know, start looking to see, you know, what are you leaking out there? Mm-hmm. For instance, you know, how much data of yours is being leaked, let's say through your phones. Many of us don't think about location. Or, you know, how much location information there is, for instance, in a photograph that we post on social media. You know, how much information are we giving away, even without our own knowledge?
Which is, it's actually a great point, because I was reading about an instance where or basically just to foreground this, that it's not just in the cyber realm, that information from what you post can be used for offline effect as well. And there was a case where I think it was a British agent was posting about something about where he was, and a Russian operative attacked him with a poisoned umbrella. They knew where he was by looking at his social media account.
And it's not only social media, right? Last year or the year before last, we were looking at reports of spear phishing emails that were being used in Syria, in war-torn Syria, to identify Syrian sympathizers. So basically the idea of these emails was they were putting a location beacon, mm-hmm. which would allow them to track who opened the email and where they were. And if you open this on your phone, they would know where you are when you're opening this email. So location information, you know, and these hacks are very easy to do. These attacks are very easy to perpetrate. These are real fears out there, not just in social media, but even, you know, what we now think of as traditional email.
Yeah, it's super interesting, and it's kind of the darker side of social media. And Dr. Vishwanath, thanks so much for taking the time out and sharing your insights with us.
Hey, thank you so much, Mike. It's a great pleasure to be here.
I've just been speaking with Dr. Arun Vishwanath, Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Buffalo. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics Podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show. Next episode, if all goes according to plan, we'll have Dr. Dean Freelon from here at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, to discuss the role of computational methods in studying social media and what recent limitations in access to Facebook data mean for the future of social media research. And as always, you can connect with us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast. Visit us on the web, socialmediaandpolitics.org. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Chapel Hill. See you next time.